Initiate Cowrat Podcast.
So today we're going to talk about the third part of our byline or our tagline, which is fun. So one of the things we both do for fun is mostly board games.
When we're bored.
You know.
Wait, do we do it when we're bored, or do we do it and it causes us to become bored?
Actually, I just meant to emphasize board games as opposed to just saying games. But
I see.
Yes, but then there is that, Chris, he'll throw that one randomly out. It's like, do you want to play a board game? Anyway, I need to first confirm or deny it. So one of the games, I think I've only played it once or twice. I played it with Jim, probably. I want to say I think it's this game, Agricola, that, as the saying goes, Linda always wins. Is that the one that she always wins at?
Yes. Yeah. So we always just say, whoever comes in second is the actual winner. We're competing amongst ourselves, not with Linda, but she's just in the game.
Oh, my gosh. Don't know how that happens.
I think Jim won once, and yeah, he was kind of ecstatic. And I said, wait, now are we counting Linda?
We'll mention it up front. I was trying to put this in the notes, which I didn't find out about until a couple months ago or a month or so ago. There's a guy that works in the same company I do that is seriously into board games. I mean, he's played like 600 different games, and I forget how many games he's owned and sold. But he told me about this website called BoardGameGeek.com.
Yes, I've been on it many times. Yep.
So that's one way to go find out about games you probably not going to hear about or have never heard about.
Yeah, they got good reviews, and people have comments and questions about games, about the rules or whatever. I've looked at a few games that they've reviewed on that website. I'm kind of trying to find a good World War II card game, something that doesn't take like 3 hours to play and an hour to set up.
Like Memoir 44, exactly. Your current favorite World War II game.
That's right. But something quick and simple would be fun, but I love the World War II theme.
Yeah, so my son Ben put me in a headlock one time and made me play Memoir 44 with him.
Right.
But the scenarios isn't part of their goal, is that it's pretty much realistic. Most of the battles end up turning out how they really did in history, or there's still a fair bit of chance.
I guess I don't know. I mean, you're rolling dice and drawing cards, so there's quite a bit of chance.
Yeah.
But they do try to set up the battles kind of as much as you can on a simple board game compared to real life.
Yep.
So as much as you can, they try to set up the map, the rivers, the mountains, the troop positions at the beginning of the battle as closely as they can to real battles from World War II, which is one thing I really like about it.
Yep.
One thing I wanted to say, I was talking to my friend at work that we were going to do this episode, and he said, you probably aren't allowed to talk about Memoir 44 the whole episode.
Yeah, we need to try and keep it moving.
Well, it's my podcast too, right? Yeah. I can do whatever I want. So
I'm the editor.
Yeah, okay. Maybe I should just start explaining Memoir 44, so probably already caught it, but it's a World War II battle simulation game. It's not like kind of a famous one for me.
Axis and Allies?
Yes. It's not like Axis and Allies where it's a map of the entire world and each person is a country, you know. This one, it's 1v1, and you just play one battle.
Yep.
Like, they have the D-Day beach landing battles.
Yep.
And it's kind of cool. So the board on one side is just a grassy field, and the other side is a beach.
Yep.
So you can pick which side you want to play on and set up. And then you have the whole board is hexes, so you can set up these hex tiles with cities, trees, hills, mountains, all that kind of stuff. And that affects the gameplay. It's like affects your movements and your attack positions. Like if you're in trees or cities, you're more defended from your enemy.
Yep.
But then if you put a tank in a city, it also hampers his attack ability because tanks aren't designed to go in small streets
spaces.
In between cities. But yeah, so they try to mimic the scenario. So you can pick a scenario from the book and then play a quote-unquote real battle from World War II. Or you can make up and design your own scenario. That's what we've done for the most part lately. We started out with playing the scenarios. The one thing I kind of don't like about the scenarios is because they're trying to base them on history, it's like, well, one side had twice as many troops as the other in this battle, so they just put it that way. And one of their suggestions is you play the game twice and switch sides after the first round.
Oh, yeah.
And then you total your points at the end of both rounds, so at least it's
like a
makes
series
it a little more
in bowling. Yeah,
so it's a little more fair. but which we've never actually done. But
I've seen plenty of photos, you guys all around the table with your World War II pan hats, yes, helmets, yes, on. How many players actually play at one time?
So the original game is just a 1v1, just two guys. Okay. Or two people. Sorry, I'm not sexist.
People, yeah.
But come on, who's playing this? This guy's. But then they did a, what they call an Overlord. Operation Overlord was the D-Day landings. That was their code name for it,
yep,
in real history. So they did the D-Day expansion where you put two boards side by side. And then the board is divided up left flank, right flank, and center. So you put two boards together. Then you have two left flanks, two middle flanks, and two right flanks. And then you put one guy, you can have up to eight players total.
Hmm.
And we've kind of tweaked the rules a little to make it better with less players because we normally don't have eight. One guy covers each third of the board, so he gets two sections that he can control. And then you have the commander-in-chief who holds the cards. He hands each player, each of his own team, one or two cards, and then they decide how they want to use them in their section of the battlefield.
Yep.
And then you can sort of help the guy on your left or right if you say, hey, bring your troops over here, help me defeat these guys. But normally everybody's just kind of focused on their own goal.
Yep.
For the most part. So it's a team effort, and then you total your points. Every time you defeat an enemy unit, you get a point, or there's also special points, like if you take this city, you get a point, but if you lose it, then it goes back. So it's kind of a, not really a King of the Hill type of thing, because usually it's, if the Americans take this city, they get a point, or
yep,
if the Germans take this city, they get a point. So usually you're defending a city, or, and one of the scenarios, like if you take a particular hill, if the Americans get one of their units on a hill, then a particular card in the deck becomes an air power card and they can drop bombs,
yeah,
you know, anywhere on the board. So it was mimicking in that particular battle. They, in the real battle, the Americans took this hill and then they could see the, pretty much all the enemy positions.
Yeah.
And they were just radioing to the bombers, telling them where the targets were.
Yeah.
So of course, in that scenario, when you're playing it, then the Germans want to knock the Americans off that hill to remove that little advantage. So
yeah,
it's all kinds of cool little quirks. This game, I don't know, I love it.
So what was your favorite game before Memoir 44?
Probably Settlers of Catan.
Yep.
Linda's cousin introduced us to the game, and then we introduced it to some friends in our church, and then it just like spread like wildfire.
So you're claiming right of first refusal on that, on introducing that. So that was like 2002 or 3, I think,
yep,
wasn't it?
Yep. Yeah. Yeah, really early, right after Lynn and I were married. So yes, maybe I'm bragging a little that it was all because of me that this game. I mean, it's a good game. The game sold itself.
So. Yeah. Oh, yeah. And yes, we know there, it's contested how you pronounce it. Is it Catan or Catan? And I've yet to find anything official. I don't think I've ever found Klaus,
really,
the inventor, commenting on this is the pronunciation. So anyway, yeah, so there's that.
Yeah. So obviously, I mean, in my head, I guess I would say everybody knows what Settlers of Catan is. It's,
yeah,
been around for a while. And it is a really popular game because it's a great game.
And the expansion, so I know you guys had Seafarers. I remember that. What's your favorite expansion to it?
I don't know. I kind of like the base game,
yeah,
probably the most. I don't know.
Especially if you're going for quick play. That's the.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. I forget there's a detail in the Cities and Knights expansion that bugs me.
That's my favorite expansion. Yeah.
Oh, really?
So
okay,
what is it?
I think that is the most popular. Okay, so you got the...
Oh, the commodities.
Commodities,
or
yeah.
Oh, boy. No resources.
No resources.
Resources.
So you got the resource cards. That's in the base game. The commodities are added...
Yep, in Cities and Knights.
In Cities and Knights. Can you trade commodities just like with other players? I forget.
You can try.
Yeah, I think you can. I think you're allowed to.
You can try. Yeah, you're allowed to, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, I can't remember. I'll have to play it again and to remind me of the one element. It's something with the commodities.
Might have to do with the trading thing or I know one thing gets quickly forgotten or misunderstood is the fabric progress, the progression. The third step in that one is you can now trade commodities at the 2-to-1 rate. And everybody forgets, like, commodities, not resources. You can, I can't remember if I looked in the almanac, if you can trade commodities 4-to-1 with the bank, quote unquote, or what. But yeah, there's some nuances. And then they changed it. So one of them was the Saboteur card,
mm-hmm,
which was in the blue deck, the political. And it just took, it turned a city into a settlement, and it cost you a wood and a ore to turn it back. And they must have thought that was lame and must have got enough feedback from other people who thought it was lame, because the new Saboteur, I forget what it does now, but it's nastier than that. Anyway, but when we have the time, we like to play that one because it makes the game longer, more complex, but in a really sensible way. It's not ridiculous. I mean, some of these games I think are designed by like mathematical nerds or mechanical nerds or something.
Yeah,
it's like,
yeah.
Let's make it as complex as we possibly can,
right.
Even though it doesn't make any sense and it's no fun.
Right. Speaking of Agricola, the game, once you get it, it's not as complex as it first seems. I don't know. Maybe that's just because it is complex. But
it's
once
like
you get
most
it,
of them, if they're well done, it might take a little bit at first, but eventually it does make sense.
Actually, how we got introduced to that game is we were just kind of like, all we play is Settlers. We want a new game. And so we went to the local game shop called the Dorkden. We just went in and said, we've been playing Settlers of Catan for like 10, 15 years. We still like it, but we're ready for a different game. Do you have any suggestions? And he says, yep, if you like that one, you're going to like this one, Agricola. And so maybe we'll just explain Agricola. Each person is in charge of a farm in the, 14th century or something like that.
Yeah.
So you have to expand your house, plow your fields, plant your fields, build fences, acquire animals.
Feed yourself.
Yeah. I've often said that this game is the closest game to real life that I've played, where you have like 87 different things you could do. But at the end of the game, you only accomplished 12, and you're like, dang it, I had so many plans.
Yep.
Where did the time go? And again, you're also struggling to survive.
Uh-huh.
And at the end of each whatever round or whatever they call it, like you have to have enough food to feed each person in your family, and if you don't, it's mega negative points.
Yep.
And of course, you want to expand your family because then you can get more work done in a day.
And you got to get that automatic feeding thing going. It's been a while since I played it last, but I just remember playing with Jim. He's like, yeah, you need to get some kind of automatic thing going here that just happens for you all the time.
Right.
So you can kind of forget about that.
A little bit,
do
yeah.
Do some of this other stuff. But
yeah, there's so many different ways in the game to do almost a self-producing food thing.
Yeah.
But again, it takes time to set it up. And if you don't set it up early in the game, it's not worth it because then the game's over before you got the full benefit.
Yeah.
Oh, what I was going to say, though, is so when Lynn and I first got that game, we introduced it to Jim and he immediately went and bought a copy, like right away. So we read the instructions, and we got through the whole, all the instructions were like, okay, so how do you play, though? It just made no sense. It's almost like if you've played checkers, you could probably pick up chess without a crazy amount of explanation. I don't know. This is just an analogy. Maybe it doesn't quite work.
It's nothing like anything else.
Yeah, it's the mechanics are nothing like anything I've ever played. Like, I remember as a kid, you play Monopoly and you play Sar, you go around the board and you pick up stuff and you roll the dice and do stuff. They're similar-ish, the mechanics.
Yep.
But there was such a different mechanic that did they forget
this
that
is a
maybe
game?
Somebody has never played anything like this? Like, it was so bizarre. We finally had to look up a YouTube video on how to play.
Interesting.
And I don't know if I went back and read the directions now, maybe I'd be like, oh, now I get it. They just didn't explain it well. Or they just forgot to explain
gameplay, yeah.
Like, they need to literally say, okay, first pick up this card and set it here. Then pick up this piece and set it here. Or you could set it here. Like, they didn't explain that part. Like,
wow.
They just... So at first we were like, what did we buy? And did we waste $50 or whatever it was?
Those games are cheap. On one hand, that's kind of an interesting commentary on a game that if it's something that's so different, that could be really good, it would be really bad.
Right, right. That's true, yeah. And it turned out to be good. We really like it. It's a fun game.
Yep.
So I remember when we first started playing Settlers of Catan.
I see what you did there.
I eventually, after playing 3 or 4 or 5 times, feel like, okay, I think I figured out a kind of a base strategy. You want to make sure you're on several different kinds of numbers. You don't want to be on a couple of 5s and a couple of 3s and a 6. Like, oh, now most dice rolls, I'm getting nothing.
Yep.
And you kind of want to spread out your resources as much as possible. In my opinion, the most important thing is to be on a variety of numbers at the beginning.
Yeah, because the 6 and 8 statistics. statistically get rolled the most, but there are games when it's like it's 5 and 10 or 5 and 3. Right. And it's like, how does this happen?
Right, yeah. So once I figured out kind of a base strategy that for the most part works for most games, or at least it's a good idea in general, then I started using that every time. I'm like, at least I didn't like what didn't always come in last, whether I won or not. But I still haven't figured that out with Agricola, and it kind of infuriates me a little bit. I don't have, every time we play, I'm like, I have no idea what to do. I mean, it's still fun, and it's complex enough that it's interesting, but it's almost like every game is so different because you got this deck of cards, and you get 5 cards, and you can use them for the whole game, but every card is unique.
Yep.
Which, by the way, I used to think the word unique meant, I'm not sure what I thought the word unique meant. I thought it meant kind of different.
Yeah, more like different than, as opposed to like nothing else.
Right, exactly. And I remember when I learned what the word unique meant from Jim, he and I, mostly him, we were explaining how to play Agricola to some new people. And he said, and every card is unique. And I said, yes, every card is completely different than every other card. There's no 2 cards that are the same. And Jim said, yeah, that's what I said, unique. I'm like, oh, wait a minute. That's what that word means. I don't know how I got into my 30-somethings without knowing that that's what that word meant. Anyways, I remember as a kid, I used to think the word, there's acceptable and something that sounds similar. But
exceptional?
Exceptional. I used to think the word exceptional meant acceptable. So acceptable is like bare minimum, you did okay, but you didn't really do great. Exceptional is like kind of amazing.
Yeah.
And when I was a kid, somebody would say that you did an exceptional job. I'm like, I thought I did good. Like, really good, above average.
That's hurtful.
Yeah, exactly.
So Jim, another one, mostly blame it on Jim, but my new son-in-law, he and his dad is a former college mate of Jim's.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're in their own universe with all their collection of eclectic games.
You're but right.
Endeavor, Age of Sail, Benjamin bought it. I can't remember who it was that influenced him, if it was Jim or if it was Mike or David. I can't remember, but that's one. We just played that last night. Have you played that one yet?
Age of Sail?
Yeah, Endeavor, Age of Sail.
Oh, I think I played Endeavor once.
Okay.
Is Age of Sail like a different version or an expansion?
I can't. That's the full name of it. It's the only one I know about. It's the only one I've seen and played.
Okay. All I've heard it called is Endeavor, so
yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, that's the main part of the name.
Yeah.
That's a good one. I tied with my daughter for second last night. David won, of course.
And that one is like a...
It's sort of a world map sort of kind of thing.
Right.
There's cards. There's placement on a board. Some placements are in water. Some is on land.
But you're like, what, 16th, 17th century expanding your empire type of thing, right?
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah, traveling to setting up territories on other continents or... Yep, okay.
Yep, that's a good one. Power Grid. I was telling Jim I need to get me a copy of Power Grid. Have you played that one with him?
No.
That one's
cool. I've heard talk of it.
It's fun. That one, I think there's a one iteration that's in Europe. I can't remember if you flip it over and it's the other side of the board is something else. That one's fun.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, there's the old classic Risk, but
right.
the meme, which is exists for a reason, the meme with the pie chart with reasons a game of Risk is completed, I think is what it is. And the tiniest slice is somebody actually wins.
Yeah, right.
The biggest slice is, what is it, loser flips the board or something like that. Second biggest one is pet knocks over the board. It's something like that, but it's...
Yeah, everybody got tired and went to bed.
Oh, gosh, yeah. Everybody quit.
3 a.m.
Yeah.
From the thrift store, I went and got... Actually, a friend of mine messaged me. He's like, hey, at the thrift store, there's a copy of Lord of the Rings Risk. I really like Lord of the Rings. I didn't discover it until the movies came out, so I'm not like a original fan or something. But I really like Lord of the Rings. I like the movies. I've watched them several times, even though they're like 3 hours long. But so I guess, I'm not sure how, but this friend of mine from high school, somehow he knew that I would like Risk/Lord of the Rings together. And he was right. I'm like, oh, that sounds awesome. So I ran right to the thrift store like the next chance I got and bought it. And I've only played it once so far. I got to find... Just got to do it, but...
Find
other victims. So I played it with my 2 oldest sons, so just the 3 of us. So I got my territories, and I'm protecting my borders. I haven't played Risk much, so...
Yeah,
I was
starting
like,
in Australia.
Kinda, well, this is this
and
is
so Lord
Middle
of the Rings,
Earth,
right. So whatever one's off in the corner.
Completely different. Yeah, right. The one that's easiest to defend.
Yeah, exactly.
Either way, so we get our, the game is going, and I'm kind of defending my borders where I think I could be attacked easily, and I feel like I'm doing pretty good, and all of a sudden, my oldest son's like, Dad, look at this. We could take out Matthias. I'm like, really? He's like, yeah. Attack him this turn, not me, and I you don't attack me,
man.
And I won't attack you. I'm like,
any of my enemy is my friend. I see where this is going.
Okay. All right, I'll do it. So I moved my troops over to more strategically attack him, left myself open to Chris. And then the next turn, he's like thinking, Chris is like looking and looking. He's like, oh, well, I might have changed my mind.
He went back on your allegiance?
On his very next turn. I don't think he was trying to deceive me at the beginning. What happened was he had this great idea, and we both said, yes, let's do it. And then later he saw how easy it would be to take me out.
Advantage of that.
Just take total advantage and just pierce me.
So he's an opportunist.
Yeah, well, I mean, I can't say I wouldn't have done the same thing, or I would have. I don't know, but I don't feel like if you're going to make a deal that you should immediately go back on it. Obviously, this is world domination, so you're going to have to say, okay, just so you know, now that he's taken out, I'm coming after you.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
You should have expected it. That's obvious. But I really didn't think it was going to be the break. And I thought hard whether I should go along with it.
Ponder factor.
I want a rematch.
One round to fortify, okay, and then come at me.
And one thing I like about Lord of the Rings Risk is, so you're each of you are like either the orcs or the humans or the elves or whatever. The ring is just traveling along the board on its own. Each turn you move the ring one space closer to Mordor. And then sometimes you draw a card for the ring. It's like, oh, the ring is delayed, or the ring, whatever, the group who's carrying the ring. And once the ring gets to Mordor, game over, whoever has the most, I don't know, points or territories wins. So it cuts the game down by a few hours.
Right.
So that's one thing I think is nice about it. So, I mean, I suppose you could just say, well, forget the ring, we're going to play till 5 a.m. and
probably make
wins.
More people want to play it.
Yeah.
It's quite the commitment. Oh, I'm playing a game of Risk. I don't know. It's 4 o'clock in the afternoon. We're probably not going to finish it today.
Yeah, exactly. One thing I wanted to say about Memoir 44, just to explain it a little further. So with Memoir 44, you have, with the base game, you got all kinds of expansions and stuff, but you have infantry, armored units, which are, we just say, tanks,
yep.
And artillery. The infantry move a little slower, but they are more maneuverable. They can hide easier and whatever. The tanks are faster and more powerful, but again, they get hampered by terrain more easily. And the artillery move the slowest if you move them at all, because you can either move or attack.
Right.
And usually you're just like, you want to fire the guns. So they usually sit, but they can shoot the longest range. And if you're hiding in the trees from artillery, it doesn't matter. They drop their
they will find you.
They drop their full power on you. Like if a tank attacks you and you're hiding in the trees, they do less damage, but the artillery does full damage every time.
Yeah.
So you play a card, and it says, like, order 2 units in the left flank, or order 1 unit in each flank, or move all units in the center flank, or order 4 armored units, and you get +1 die when you attack. So there's way more different kinds of cards. I read an article on it, and once I read this, it felt like it made more sense. They said, this is not a board game. This is a card game with a board game attached. And once I thought of it that way, like, think about your cards more than you're thinking about what you're doing on the board, that really helped me to, like, plan your strategy based on your cards, is essentially what it was saying. Because if you run out of cards that are helping you in your left flank, then you're stuck, you know?
Right.
But one of the cards is Medics and Mechanics. So you pick a unit, and you can repair it or heal it.
Yep.
If it's infantry, you can add health points back to it, or if it's tanks, you can add health points. And then it says, and then give it an order, so it can move and attack after that. But you have to roll the dice. If the dice roll up nothing, then you just wasted your card and nothing happened. So everything you do is kind of a risk, but... So I was playing with multiple people, but Jeriel, he was across the board from me, and so I was mainly me and him in our section that were fighting it out. And so I attacked this tank unit of his, and it was a 4-unit tank. Most of the tanks are 3, but the Germans have these special ones that have more, that are stronger against attack, so they get 4 hit points instead of 3. And so I whittled him down to one or two, something like that. I'm like, okay, next turn I'm going to take him out. He plays a medics and mechanics card. Rolls the dice, broom, back up to full health. Comes at me. Dang it. I was so close. Or at least halfway there, more, whatever it was. And so I'm like, all right. Then I kind of regroup since he did some damage to me. Went back to him, started whittling those tanks down more. Got it down again to one or two. I can't remember. He plays another medics and mechanics card, just like pulling my hair out.
It's like watching a game of soccer. Right. You know, all the way down to the other end. Then, oh, no, no, we're going back the other way. Oh, no.
That was slightly infuriating.
Now, I think another one that Benjamin has is Seven Wonders.
Oh, okay.
Have you played that one yet?
I have not.
No, I'm not. Okay. I think I've played it maybe two or three times. Can't comment on that, but there's a name for you, Seven Wonders. See, another gym one, I think, is Ticket to Ride.
Yep.
Played that one.
Yep, we have a copy. We bought a copy of that. That's kind of a fun one. You said you have played it?
Yeah. She's trying to build a continuous railroad track across the U.S.? Or as long as possible or something like that?
Yeah, like the longest track gets points. There's multiple ways to get points. So, yeah, it's a map of the entire U.S. I mean, they have different continents and different,
yeah,
like, cities, if you want. They'll zoom in on a city and the whole board. But the base game is the entire U.S. I think that was the first one.
Yeah.
So there's multiple, like, major cities all over the board. And you draw a card that says, build a track from New York to Minneapolis.
Yep.
And so if you complete this track, you get 10 points. And then you can draw more cards. But if you, at the end of the game, if you haven't completed a track, those could become negative points.
Yep.
My kind of strategy is to try to draw more points at the beginning of the game, or draw more cards at the beginning of the game. Because what I found is, because if you draw more cards, you might say, let's say it says draw from A to B, and the next one is like draw from A to C, like, or not draw, but build a track. Like, oh, these tracks overlap. So I can use my resources and build one track from this city to this city and get two cards fulfilled in that one shot. Like, so that's kind of what I like to try to do. Yeah. But again, then the downside is if I draw too many cards and you aren't able to finish, then And some of the tracks can be taken up. Like, there's multiple routes from different cities. That, but, like, all of a sudden you're like, oh, great, I'm blocked. Yep. It's impossible to get there at this point for the rest of the game. So you kind of got to watch that.
And a quick fun one, again, another gym one, is King of Tokyo.
Mm-hmm.
Played that one with him.
Yeah, we bought that for our boys. They really liked that one.
Yep.
The concept is funny. The,
yeah.
The 1960s monsters like that are similar to Godzilla and King Kong and whatever else. Then they add a bunch of silly ones, robots and whatever. I played that with Jim and a few other people a while back, and I wish I could remember the details better at this point, but it was my first time ever playing, and so Jim was kind of walking me through, but I was also against him, you know.
Yeah.
And I suddenly realized with this combination of cards I had, like, if you play this card, like, everybody in the game, including yourself, loses 3 hit points. I was like, I have 4. Everyone else has 3. I will win if I play this card. Yep. And so I'm like all excited. And I'm like, I can't believe it. And Jim's just like, really? You're excited? You think you're going to win? He's like needling me, and which he always does in every game. And I'm like, yes, I'm going to win if I play this card. He's like, oh, okay, interesting. Like, he's not scared. And so I play it, and he whips over a card that says, like, you know, undo the previous card that your opponent plays or something like that. Or nullifies the whatever.
Yeah.
One game, another is just from walking into the Dork Den. Me and my youngest son were just on a bike ride on the way home. We went by the Dork Den, and I was just like, you know what sounds fun? Let's go to the Dork Den, see if they have a cheap game that'll be fun. I wasn't looking to spend too much money. I got sucked in, and I spent too much money. More than I wanted to, I'll say.
Yeah.
I was looking for just like a simple card or dice games. And again, not complex and takes 3 hours to play, but that's what I ended up buying. It was just Lord of the Rings, which I didn't know this existed. Apparently, it's a 20-year-old game, and it was like the 20th anniversary edition.
Hmm.
And I'm just staring at the cover. I'm like, I don't even know how to play this or what it is, but I feel like I have to buy it. And again, it's a very different... I had posted online about it on this, the Lord of the Rings Facebook fan group that I'm in. and somebody's like, I have yet to figure out how this game works. Again, similar to Agricola. The mechanics are just so different from any other game. This one, I think I did watch a YouTube video for this one also. But it's kind of fun. It takes you through each of the main plot points of the story.
Okay.
And so that's kind of a different sort of concept, I think, for a game. A lot of games that are based on stories are just like the fighters that are in the story, you're just in the world and you fight bad guys, whatever.
Yep.
But it doesn't really follow the plot. But this one really takes you through and like events happen in the game, or like the orcs advance. So parts of the game are similar every single game because it takes you through the story every time. But the decisions you make, and there's, again, random drawing of cards and tiles that do different things. And this one is a cooperative. It's everybody, all the humans against the game. Hmm. And apparently it was one of the first cooperative board games, which is kind of cool, I think. So in this one, each person is just a hobbit. You're not Legolas or Gimli or Gandalf or anything, which is kind of sad, I think. But but each person is a hobbit, and you're all trying to get the ring to Mordor. You draw cards that kind of you can use that are the other warriors in the game and whatnot.
I suppose they do it that way. Yeah. Makes it more accessible and more generic in one way. And
yeah. So kind of like other cooperative board games, there's all these things happening and you're trying to cover all your bases, but you're just barely covering all your bases the whole game and you're feeling like you're about to lose at any moment, which is actually kind of a cool way to do it for Lord of the Rings, because that's the whole story, is like they were constantly on the verge of losing.
Right.
The whole story. It was 9 people against like army of thousands.
Let's see. It involves, you lay the cards out and they're thicker cards, it's like a 5x5 matrix or something like that. And then there's a card. The main part of the gameplay is that you have to get your team to say the right words. You basically try to use one word to describe it to try to get them to say as many of yours as possible without giving.
Yeah, we've played that. We had that. Our Linda's cousin gave it to us for Christmas. We had no idea what it was. And so there's code words, but the one we have like a different version of it. It's code words pictures.
Okay.
So I guess the original is you lay out a bunch of tiles and each tile has a word or words on it.
Word, yep.
Okay. This one is pictures.
Okay. So the thing, as a family, we've played it a handful of times, but I think one of the most memorable things, anytime in the future if we sit down to play it, somebody will cite the one particular game we played when we were visiting, I think it was when we were visiting Andrew. I think he had it maybe. And I was the one doing the describing, and I used some obscure, like, inside joke kind of thing, tip, and he got the right word because of this bizarre, obscure, whatever.
Right. And so he knew what you were talking about.
Exactly. He knew my frame of mind. So it's like, anyway, the fun part about that game is the different personal dynamics depending upon who you're playing with and how they know you. And so you can get away with stuff like that where you throw out these obscure, unrelated words. I wish I could remember what the combination was, but it was really bizarre. And everybody's like, no way.
That's similar to,
it's like playing Pictionary or something like that, too. Or right. Depending on who's in the crowd, it's like, okay, I know they'll recognize this.
Right. Yeah, if you know the other person well enough, you can use that to your advantage in the game.
Yep.
There's a game that we used to play a bunch way back. It's you try to get your team to guess the word. I think you can say anything you want, but you only have like a few seconds. So there's not all these tight restrictions on what you can say. It's just a time restriction. You just can't say any part of the word.
Okay.
So say it's applesauce. You're like, it grows on trees, and you can put it in a bowl and mash it and put sugar in it and like, you know, whatever. And the parent time's up.
Yep.
If you don't go quick enough. But we've used that same tactic, like, okay, it's in your bedroom on your shelf.
Yeah, yeah.
Above, right, the books.
Yeah.
Like nobody else would catch that except for them.
This is the most recent time we played Pictionary. Played it with extended family up north. I don't know how this happened. That's all I'll say. But it was really fun for once. But I was just like totally killing it. And everybody's like, what the heck is going on? How is this happening? I'm like, I don't know. But it's fun.
Because you're killing it.
Yeah. And I don't normally.
I have this joke I always use when I start losing game. I've never liked this game. It's always been a dumb game. I just remembered Settlers of Catan.
Yeah.
So one of the ways you can get points is to build the longest road.
Yes.
And if somebody surpasses you and builds a longer road, then they take those points from you.
Yes.
You can also get the largest army, same thing. I've been known in my family since I was a child and among all my friends that I cannot make a decision. I can't make a decision in life, let alone a game.
That's the origin of the phrase ponder factor.
Yeah, right. And the joke is like, if we forgot whose turn it is, it's probably Tim's. Because it's always Tim's turn. 90% of the game, it's Tim's turn. Because I cannot decide what I want to do. Or I get distracted talking and telling a story. Even if I'm not, I just cannot make a decision. And so I'm just looking at all the options, and I look at them again, and I look at them again, and I think, like, okay, well, there's a downside to this decision, so I don't want to do that. There's a downside to this decision, so I don't want to do that. Well, maybe I should do the option A again. No, there's a downside. It's like, there's a downside to everything. Just make it.
And then if you're playing with Jim, he probably says something like, it means the game.
That's exactly right.
No pressure.
So I don't remember if it showed up in the mail or if he gave it to me, but I got a gift from Jim a few years ago, and it was just this thin little package. So I opened it up, and it was a card. It was a...
Oh, yes. Yes. Longest turn card. Yeah. -1 point.
-2 points.
2 points. Yeah. Yes.
Because if you have the longest road, it's 2 points. Longest army is 2 points.
Yeah, I need to get like, that. That's well played. Whoever came up with that first, that
was
well played.
Hilarious. Yep. And I'm looking at this thing. I'm like, this looks like it came with the game.
I know
this, it was really well done. Well, high quality. And this was a game that I played when I was a kid. And when I was a kid, it was, like, amazing. I couldn't believe it. It was so fun. It was a board game with a computer attached to it. So you had to push buttons on this little computer, and it would respond to you and tell you certain things, what was going on in the game or whatever. It was called Omega Virus. I don't know if you've ever seen or heard of this.
No. There's your 90s retro game kind of deal there.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. So the setting is you're on a spaceship or a...
Space station?
Yeah, you're on a space station. It's up to four players, and each of you is a computer virus hunter. And so you got this cool looking little guy on the board. There's all these rooms. There's like, I don't know, 50 or 100 rooms in this space station. And so you're looking for the computer virus, which I don't know, this doesn't make really sense for real, but it was fun. And so you enter a room, and then on the computer, you have to push, each room has a 3-digit code, and you enter a room, then you punch into the computer, this 3-digit code, and then the computer tells you what you found in there. Hmm. Or it tells you if the virus is attacking you, and then you have to defend yourself, and like it's shooting lasers at you and whatever. The space station, every once in a while in between turns, is like, help me, help me. Because the...
That's not creepy.
The guy, I know. The computer on the space station is like an artificial intelligence, but it's being taken over by the Omega virus.
Oh, yes.
And the virus taunts you as you're playing. It's like, you human scum, you can't beat me. It's just kind of fun and silly. But I just remember it being just this awesome, amazing game. I just was so fun when I was like 8 or 10 years old.
Yep.
And so for whatever reason, it came to mind several years ago. And I'm like, oh, I want to get this for whatever one of my sons was about the right age that I thought he would like it. Really, I wanted to play it. And so I found it on eBay for like $60. I did not want to spend $60, but whatever. That's the cheapest one I could find. So I bought the game, came, we set it up to play. And at the end of the game, I'm like, this is kind of boring, actually. It was fun when you're 10, I guess.
Technology will taint you like that.
Yeah, right. That's true. And just the mechanics of the gameplay just were not that interesting.
I've outgrown you.
For an adult.
Yep. Stratego. That one still exists. That's kind of a classic. That's pretty basic, but...
Yeah, that I always struggled with Stratego to, like, didn't have a great strategy. I'm just like, I don't know, pick a guy and just start pounding through the enemy until he dies, and then send the next guy until you eventually a strategy might present itself.
Yeah. There's a card game, super generic, called Tripoli. Comes with this felt mat that has a, it kind of looks like a roulette wheel, but what it is, it's specific, like the 8, 9, 10, based around hearts. They call it kind of a combination of hearts and rummy and something else, but it's mostly the way the cards are dealt. But it's a relatively mindless, but different than some games. I don't know how else we played that last, but David, of course, didn't like it because it was relied pretty much totally on the luck of all the cards dealt.
Yeah,
which he despises. But
yeah, I learned that. We set up this game, played Memoir 44, and a few moves in, he's like, this game is mostly chance. I'm like, well, but that. It's fun. He's like, yeah, but it's not a real game.
I have no impact on this game. I'm just a pawn.
Right.
There's a series of games, I'll have the names in the show notes, but almost looks like a pack of gum. It's about how big it is, but it's a bunch of little slim cards, tiny, well, it's just tiny epic galaxies.
Yes.
That's actually not one of those, but that reminds me of it. But there's a bunch of these little tiny games that are, one of them I think has what looks like dice on it, combination of dice or something, but my son has a bunch of those simple things, travel games, you know, stuff you can carry with you, play if you got 15 minutes to kill someplace.
Right. So we had, when I was a kid, me and my best friend in grade / high school, we're kind of got obsessed with like trying to make a board game from scratch, like build, like invent one. And the first try was, I don't know if you remember Monsters in My Pocket, these tiny little rubber, kind of hard rubber figurines about an inch or two tall. They were just weird looking monsters, like all kinds of like dinosaur or octopus or gorilla type monsters sort of. And I don't know, I never found out, maybe I should research this just for fun, but on the bottom of each one there was a number. It's like one, I think it went from 0 to 10 or the, and I don't know why. I don't, it wasn't a game as far as we could tell. You could just buy these things. And I started collecting them, and he started collecting them too. We had this whole pile of these, and we're like, we got to do something with these. And so we got this tag board, and we started drawing this big map and whatever. And we just decided that on the bottom of each monster was its power level or whatever, or attack or something. It was fun designing, you know, drawing the stuff and figuring out the rules. And then we start playing, and eventually we're like, but it's kind of boring because we don't know how to make a game that's fun and challenging and not too challenging.
Yeah, it's tricky.
You have to have interesting decisions.
Yeah.
And I still, to this day, I'm like, it seems like some kind of, I don't know, magic. Like, how do you make a game? And the best that I've come up with is that, kind of like Memoir sort of gives me an idea, like, you can do stuff on the board, but only if you have the right cards in your hand. So, like, you could take a deck of cards and say, okay, if you get 3 hearts, that allows you to do this action.
Yep.
Or if you have 2 hearts, none of this. Like, so then the decision-making is a lot of, you have to draw and discard until you get the cards you want. So you have to figure out, what am I going for? Like, well, I have, these are the cards in my hand. I should probably go for this because that's most likely what I'm going to get. But then that changes halfway through or whatever.
Yeah.
So I've thought, like, if you can connect that to something else. I did do an attempt at a board game. And again, because it was like 8-year-olds, it was fun for them.
Yeah.
But as a game, it wasn't great. But when our son was, I don't know if he's 8 or 9 years old, something like that, his birthday was coming up and he wanted to do a pirate theme. And so he was like, I want to play all kinds of pirate games. And he had all these wild ideas that were just like, I don't know. This seems big and complicated and time consuming. And so what I did is I came up with an idea for like a board game, but it took up the whole living room floor. So we got this like blue painter's tape and we made a grid across like the whole living room floor.
Yep.
And I took these little blocks of wood and I just sanded the ends down so there's a point on each end. So it looked like a little ship. And then I went into Photoshop and I found all kinds of like pirate logo / like skull pictures. So that each ship, the sails on the ship had some kind of emblem or logo that, so you knew which ship was yours.
Yep.
So they all looked piratey, but they were each unique. That's that word again.
Supposed to say piratey things.
That's right. And I think there was like 10 kids or something. I know your son was one of them.
Yeah.
And I forget what the deal was, but he did something different than everybody else, which just confused everybody. Something like he didn't care about winning. He just wanted the candy or he something. I can't remember. So then I made these cards that you had to collect 4 cards of the exact all the same kind. So kind of like a...
Yeah, 4 of a kind.
Yeah, I get 4 of a kind. But each card was the corner of a treasure map. So you had to put all 4 together. And that told you how to get this treasure on a particular island. And so we made it all fair each. So there were, 10 kids. So we made 10 islands. Yep. And we came up with fun, cool names like Forbidden Island and Mystical Island and all kinds of fun, you know, Treasure Island and whatever. And so we cut out these little shapes and then we wrote the words on there and just laid them all around this hex, this giant grid. And then on each island, we put, Linda ordered these cardboard boxes that were in the shape of like a treasure chest. And so we put all kinds of plastic gold coins, but also like, like Werther's Originals.
Oh, yeah.
Because they're kind of gold color. Yeah. And so we fill them up with all this treasure and candy / plastic coins and whatever. And so each kid could get a box, but you had to get your map first, and then you had to travel to the island once you figured out what island this was going to. And then so each kid would draw a card on his turn, and you could trade with cards with the other players. So you're like, oh, who's got this island? I got two pieces of Treasure Island. I got one piece. I'll give you that if you give me this. And so, yeah, it was kind of fun. And I think we incorporated British ships just going back and forth, and you could attack them to get points or something. I can't remember, but the kids loved it. So that was my, I was like, yes, I finally made a game that children enjoy. And at first we were like, okay, on your turn, you can trade one card. And the next person's turn, he could trade one card. And we're like, this game is going to take 10 hours. We realized, we're like, okay, free for all. Just start yelling out. You can trade. It doesn't have to be your turn.
Like playing Pit. Four.
Exactly.
Two.
That Pit, that's another good one. I always liked Pit. For whatever reason, nobody in my family really likes it. I don't get it.
Spoons, that's another one you can...
Yeah.
The boys, well, actually, they did this not too long ago either. Your sons were over here, and they made a bunch of Star Wars Lego figurines.
Oh.
But the boys used to do these different, they'd make like a board, and they'd make all these things out of Legos. They'd make a whole bunch of the same thing, so it would be like an army of whatever, and incorporate the Lego figurines or Lego objects into some kind of game, or some do a battle of some kind with
all these
different things they made.
My brother and a friend of his invented this Lego game. So they would each build a castle, I think, or at least one of them would have a castle. Maybe there was just an attacker and a defender. But they would march their little army Lego guys, or, you know, like medieval army guys up, and they had these cannons, and you could shoot, like, I'm going to try to hit this part of the castle, roll a dice, and like, okay, you have to remove that many pieces off of your castle, like damage.
Oh,
and
cool.
Then once there was a big enough hole, you could march your guys in there. I thought that was kind of a cool concept, kind of a 3D, like doing actual damage.
Yeah, using the old creativity. That is one aspect of humanity that's like God talks about, let us make man in our own image. And that is one of the aspects of our makeup that is like God, that is an attribute he gave us, which is we like to be creative.
Mm-hmm.
People use their creativity in different mediums. Like mine, I would say, is photography. I spend a lot of time, I'll take a bunch of pictures, and then I'll spend a lot of time basically trying to make them look as nice as I think they can look. Or once in a while, I'll stylize something. A lot of times, I try to sort of stick with reality, but try to make them look as nice as possible, especially if they're shot under poor conditions, things like that. But creativity, that is definitely something that God has given us, because he is like that. If you look at the universe, all the stuff, and some of the freaky sea creatures and all this stuff, it's like, okay, now you're just showing off. It's because you can create anything and cause it to function however you want it to function.
Right,
because you hardwire its DNA to produce these chemicals and whatever in their body that allow them to live like this, to live at the depths of the ocean with no sunlight, all these different things. But that's definitely an aspect of being human that is a way that we are like God, like he said, we'll make them in our image. So games are some people's way of expressing that or fleshing that out.
Yeah, either creating games, again, that's the creative side, but almost all games are problem solving. You're setting up, there's a problem that you have to solve and you don't know how to do it, and you have to think and strategize and figure out how you're going to either beat the other guy or solve the puzzle or whatever. I remember my dad talked about that with people. He's like, games are just problems we set up for ourselves to solve. Which seems...
Yeah, why would you do that?
What? Who would do that?
But everyday life's enough problem solving.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, but this isn't for real. This is, we're pretending we have a problem. We're gonna...
Right. There's one podcast I was listening to, and he's talking about how there's so many computer games mostly, but video games that are like work simulators. They're simulating someone else's job.
Yeah.
And so you come home from work, and to relax, you simulate someone else's work. Of course, it's usually something more interesting than what you do, probably, but.
Right. And there's nothing to lose.
Yeah, and he said even like there's, you know, semi-truck simulator games where all you do is just drive.
Yep.
You're not building a semi-truck, you're not buying and selling, you're just driving.
Yep.
I'm like, what?
Yeah, I think my son had some game like that. I know it was one of his cousins does too. Something to that effect.
I can see it being addictive, but on the other hand, I'm like, what? You're just...
That would be something you're really interested
you're
in.
You're just seeing the scenery go by and you're turning the steering wheel occasionally. Like, that's the whole game. But it's like a kind of a low-stress road trip, I guess, that you can start and stop whenever you want because it's simulated.